Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Bulls are back. First week up in the last four. Apple hits an all-time high. Sell Rosh Hashanah and buy Yom Kippur. Worked out pretty well. We have a framework for a skinny trade deal, a look at what was and what's ahead, and some thoughts on WeWork. All this and much more on episode number 632 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. Andrew Horowitz here. I am the host, of course, of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as the co-host of DH Unplugged, where myself and John C. Dvorak get together each and every week on Tuesday nights and talk about the lighter side of finance. You have to listen to understand what that means exactly. But we do that live 9 o'clock on Tuesday evenings. That's Eastern time. So make sure you get that. You can also, of course, find all of the podcasts that we do over on the various podcast directories that are out there. You know, I was thinking about this over the week, and you know, this is episode number 632, and we have, I don't know, somewhere around, I guess it's about 300 or 400 of DH Unplugged. For a while back there, I had another podcast that I did about 80 episodes. I was a substitute, believe it or not, on the Money Girl podcast for about a year. So that was about 50 episodes. So we're approaching, I don't know, well over 1,000 episodes of information related to the area of finance, investments, education. It's been a great run, doing this since about 2007. That's right. In a way, I'm kind of the OG of financial podcasting, I guess. And it's really a lot of fun because it brings me a great deal of knowledge from the weekly prep that we do to make sure that we have some very interesting things to talk about, as well as the guests that we bring on. Now, we haven't had guests in a while on the show, and there's kind of a couple of reasons for that. One of them is that we got a lot of feedback from listeners over the last 6 months, and it seemed to say that, you know, they really like when I have a full show without a guest, unless that guest is super interesting. All right, so we've had some really great guests on, but we just, you know, we go in and out. We have guests, we don't have guests, and just for a little while, we're going to kind of go it alone, then bring back a whole bunch of really good guests. So we'll see what happens with that. Now, what happened with the stock markets, or shall I say the psychotic world of investing in stock markets? Recently, we saw what I think looked like an oversold condition for markets last week. We saw that there was, on our key reversal indicator, a cluster formed, and there's a little dot that goes on the chart after a very thorough calculation that we have put together. And I saw that there was this oversold condition, you know, kind of towards the mid part of the week, and that correlated pretty well to the idea that we were going to get at least a reversal rally to make up for that deficit. The fact that there was this oversold condition that has had arrived. And, you know, it did happen. But one of the things that I also noticed that it wasn't so oversold, it wasn't so deep that there was, you know, like a lot of people say, blood in the streets. It wasn't like back up the truck, you got to get in there. Man, things are so overdone. Investors are at a level of despondency and they're just throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You know, they're just absolutely looking at this whole thing as that it's never going to get better. I'm not going to invest. I'm going to hold off on everything, you know, keep myself in cash. Even though we did see a number that came out once again that showed that individual investors, retail investors are pulling money out of the market, out of equities into fixed income at a pretty good clip. But it really wasn't that bad that it was like, okay, well, you know what? Just hold your nose and dive in. It was just a general oversold situation. So what we have seen is that that did resolve itself to the upside. And again, we did have the first week in about four that major indices managed to climb and finish into the positive territory. And one of the recent things that I've seen that I don't know if you've seen this, but it appears that the first part of the week has been kind of messy with markets. More towards the down than the up. Monday, Tuesday, going into Wednesday, slight possible reversal into the close on a Wednesday and Thursday, and definitely Friday have been good days, up days for markets, which is kind of unusual. If you think about the psychology for a second of markets and you think that investors who maybe are a little bit skittish, concerned about, I don't know, some of the headwinds that are out there, what would happen over an elongated weekend where they don't have the opportunity to trade? Well, if you think about that for a second, you have to realize that the probability is that they're not going to want to hold on to a position over the weekend into what could be some kind of disastrous announcement, or who knows what they're thinking about why that would be. But what's really interesting is that just the opposite is occurring. What we're seeing is that money is being pushed into the markets on a Friday towards the end of the week, where investors have confidence that they're willing to hold over the weekend in the hopes, I guess, of some kind of good news announcement that will happen, maybe a merger acquisition, maybe some kind of a break in the trade deal, who knows, that they're confident enough to hold on over the weekend into Monday. Now, maybe what's happened on Monday is they liquidate those positions as none of the good news has come to be. So maybe that's what's going on there. But it's a little bit of a strange thing that's happening. And I think that's part and parcel of the bigger picture, because right now it looks like, from all accounts, that what we have going on is the hope trade. You know, think about it. We have hope that a trade deal gets done. We have hope that the Fed will continue to be dovish. We have hope that the economy and the economic slowdown is going to be just temporary, and, you know, it's just a dip. It's just a pause that refreshes. We have hope that earnings are going to come out better than expected. We have hope that the global economic slowdown is not going to hit here and is bottoming. So there's a lot of hope going on involved in the current economic and market condition that seems to be really prevalent with investors. That, you know what, even if in fact we are in a bad time, and who knows, maybe some of these things won't play out, it's only temporary. Let's not look tomorrow or the next day or the next week or month. Let's really look out a little bit further, which frankly is a healthy way to look at it. And that's probably the most appropriate. Because if you look back on a chart and you take a weekly or a monthly candle and a time frame and you look back in history, all the little areas that were the biggest concerns, the market drops, resolved as companies are able to continue refining their process, enhancing their earnings, bringing more revenue. And what happens is that, yeah, markets generally go, if you look at a chart, and I'm talking about indices in general here now, from bottom left to top right over a long stretch of time. So if you think about that and you're looking at that, then there has to be some reasonable belief that some of these things that are out there that are considered headwinds, well, maybe just temporary. And temporary, by that I mean, well, it could be a month or a six-month period or maybe even a year or so. But you can't market time really well. In fact, anybody who's tried it for a period of time knows it's not the easiest thing to get right on a consistent basis. There's no way. But one of the things that we're talking about when it comes to this hope deal and the hope that this is something that will be resolved sometime in the future, I think if I was to rate those, if I was to score those and to say, okay, which one of these is the most important? Which one of these is really going to be something that is taken by markets to say, you know, okay, that is what we're really watching right now. And I think it's probably, I would say it's a tie between a trade deal and a true trade deal. I'm going to talk about that in a second, and earnings. I mean, even if earnings are light and there's maybe even some ugly guidance and outlook that is really concerning about the forward look for many companies that are dependent on the cost of goods from several of these areas that maybe have tariffs related to them. And maybe if companies talk about, well, you know, the global slowdown, there's really some problems there. And that really weighs on their outlook and their estimates on a go-forward basis. If in fact there is a solid, I mean, a true and absolute solid trade deal done, I think that there is the concept that there's a light at the end of the tunnel here for many of these companies, and that a lot of the damage that was done by the tariffs, by the trade war, and by the political uncertainty revolving around multi-country deals will be seen as temporary, and that you could see beyond the next quarter, or maybe even the next 2 quarters. Because I do believe when it comes to the earnings in the next quarter, this does seem like the timing is really ripe for some companies to do really well in terms of their actual numbers versus expectations. And we saw that with Fastenal this week that came out with a much better than expected number. And they are they're in it, the center of it, when it comes to what could be impacted by this trade dispute. So there's going to be a lot of beats because expectations have been brought down so significantly by analysts. And we see this every quarter. We see that analysts go out and they look for, okay, you know, what are we going to have 2 quarters out? And we see a really good number. By the time the actual earnings come out, they've reduced their number significantly in order to make it a lot easier for companies to beat. And don't forget that companies are feeding them information as well and providing them. I mean, this is a game. We know this. And if you don't know this, I'll give you a quickie on this, right? What companies do is they feed the analysts information to make it look as though that they have a pretty good idea of what their forward guidance is going to be, as well as what their next quarter or the current quarter is going to be for earnings. And then what happens is that the company will magically beat, because what they did was they were conservative when it came to guidance to the analysts. The analysts post their numbers based on what they receive for the information from the companies. So really, this is a big game. So we may see some beats that are happening right now, but I think the most important thing that we really need to be focusing in on is the guidance and the commentary from some of these companies that really have a multinational exposure when it comes to their outlook. And what are they saying? What are they feeling? What's going on? Is there really an impact at this point on their margins? That's going to be something to look at. What's going to be looking, and what are we going to be seeing with margins? Now, of course, 1 quarter doesn't make for an absolute trend. There's no question about that. However, we need to really focus in on how long is this trade war, these tariffs, going to be impacting these companies, and what is that going to do to their outlook moving forward? And I mean, I think we got to talk about, well, this trade deal. What happened with the trade deal on Friday? There was a lot of anticipation throughout the week because the Chinese delegation came in. They were talking with Mnuchin and Lighthizer, and then there was going to be a big meeting with President Trump on Friday that was scheduled to be at 2:45 in the afternoon, very well positioned at the end of the day in order not to spook the markets and have enough time to do some explanation and backtracking if needed be, if markets didn't like what was said. This is a game, folks. This is all about confidence, instilling confidence about something. But what we saw was an announcement on Friday that there was going to be this substantial, I mean, this wonderful phase one completion of a trade deal. This is the first time we heard any kind of inference to a phase. Well, what do you mean a phase? In the past, we heard that, well, maybe we'll do some kind of light deal. And then President Trump said, absolutely not. We're going to have either a great deal or none at all. And he stuck to that for a long time. And then somehow, all of a sudden on Friday, we have a phase one, a trade deal that was really tremendous. a substantial move forward. And then we had to have an explanation of what does that mean? Phase one, phase two. Well, we've heard of trade deal light, a skinny trade deal. These are all the names that were being put upon the potential for what was going to be happening. It looked like markets were really forcing his hand to get something done. But let me tell you what actually happened. Let's get down to the brass tacks of what we found, which was announced more towards 3:30 or so in the afternoon, by the way. It was supposed to be 2:45. It ended up being somewhere around 3:30 or so, 3:40. And I'll just give you the follow-up and then go backwards. Let's just say that markets were up about 500 points on the Dow Jones Industrial Average right before the announcement in anticipation of some kind of deal and these leaks that were coming out, and the news media was providing headlines and information. And what ended up happening was there was an immediate drop in the end of the day in the last 15, 20 minutes of about 200 points off of that, or 240 points approximately off of that, to end the day still solidly up, but significantly pulling back. The good news was that the markets closed because we did end up on the low end of that waterfall down. All the move up from about 11 o'clock in the morning till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon was totally taken out. But what happened? Why did this happen? Was it simply just a, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news kind of thing? Or what happened? So this skinny, well, we're not calling it a skinny trade deal anymore. We're calling it phase one. Phase one. What we heard of is this great deal for both sides. Well, we got a delay in tariffs. That was first of all. The increase in tariffs on October 15th that was supposed to go into play and move some things up from 25 to 30% that were going to affect are no longer going to be. They're going to be delayed or permanently shut down. So, but remember, the current tariffs on that tranche is still in place. Then we had some kind of agreement in principle on currency transparency. And then the follow-up to that was that if we can get all these things done, and if in fact everybody agrees eventually to this, that maybe we will stop labeling China as a currency manipulator. That was from Steve Mnuchin. We also got a framework in principle that in 4 to 5 weeks, we're going to get all this down in paper and then review it. An agreement or a framework in principle and 4 to 5 weeks to get it down on paper to review. Now, why did I just repeat that? Because I want to make sure you heard that. In other words, any of the things I'm talking about right now have just been talked about and yes, sounds good. Okay, let's bring it back to my people and talk about it. And then put it down on paper and then we can negotiate from there. In other words, we do not have a trade deal. We do not have anything that has changed except for one thing. President Trump, who has the power to do this, delayed the tariffs on the October 15th increase. We also have a commitment of agricultural purchases by China in the range of about $40 to $50 billion over a two-year period. Now, remember, this is important, that last part, because that was not initially talked about by President Trump. He just said they're going to be buying in a huge amount in the heartland, and the farmers are going to be very happy about this because it's the biggest we've ever seen from them. When I look back, just as a point of reference, before the trade war started, China was at about $20 billion per year of goods that they bought in agriculture anyway. Agricultural products averaged about $20-ish billion per year. So all they're doing is going back to where they were. And they don't have it. What do they care? They need agricultural products. So they'll buy from us. They'll buy from somebody else as long as the prices are right. Nobody said they're going to be committing to buy it no matter what the prices are. I'm sure if the prices are much higher for soybeans here than they are somewhere else, or wheat or rice or any kind of other agriculture that they are targeting at buying, that if the pricing isn't right, they're going to go buy somewhere else. But they have a commitment that they're going to try to reach this level of $40 to $50 billion. I don't really understand, by the way, why there's so much focus on agricultural products. I just don't really understand this. While I do understand there's some political reasons why that area we want to really do well. We just gave them $28 billion of a bailout because there was such a slowdown in China's buying of the products due to the fact that they were trying to get back and retaliate against us for all the tariffs that we're putting on them and all the threats that we have. We just bailed the farmers out by $28 billion. Could you imagine if the auto industry that has seen a slowdown because of the tariffs and the trade war got a, $50 million bailout? All hell would break loose. What about technology companies? Or retail? Or any other area? What is it with the whole agricultural purchases that it seems that President Trump is so hung up on? You know the answer. It's politics. It's politics. But we have this commitment, and it is the same as it was before. And we have the potential for easier access of financial companies to work in China. But overall, again, it's going to take 4 to 5 weeks to hammer out the details on paper. As President Trump said, it has to be papered. We have to get this papered. If you really think about what happened here, there is no changes in the current tariff levels that we have in place from either country. There's a commitment that sometime over the next 2 years, that China will ramp up their buying to be in the $40 to $50 billion range for agricultural products over that period of time, whether they start now, or they start in 3 months, or they start in 6 months. Now, President Trump says, we can see that they're buying because the prices of agriculture are starting to move up, and that shows us that there's buying going on. That does not show us that. The price increase in agriculture, the futures of corn and wheat and soybeans moved up because there's talk about the potential for buying all this in the future. Not because there's actually buying going on. This whole deal stinks to high hell. This is total crap. Let's get this straight, put it on the table, and really all agree to this point. Is it a step in the right direction that we are talking and we're able to have at least some negotiations? Absolutely, 100%. That's great. It's not in writing. It's not signed. And it doesn't have any teeth. There's no dispute resolution that they've talked about. Now, maybe in the final version, there'll be some. But it's nothing more than huge hope. And let's get it straight. It's not a deal. And it's not the grand deal, the superb deal, the wonderful, amazing, beneficial opportunity to really level the playing field when it comes to trade with China. It has nothing to do with intellectual property. It has nothing to do with technology transfers. And it really does nothing but help out the farmers if that even goes into play. It doesn't help out the rest of the economy. And again, the tariffs that we currently have are still on. So what is it? I mean, if you think about it for a second, it really looks and smells like it's nothing more than a way that the U.S. has now because they wanted to, you know, avoid raising tariffs over the next couple of months and a way to placate markets. It simply looks like a way to say we have a win, but this is exactly what we've seen before. We had President Trump delaying tariffs. If you remember, he did this before and said China's going to be buying agricultural products. Well, now they added a few things that said, okay, we have a framework for this and we have an agreement in principle for that, but it's not in writing. And it doesn't alleviate the problems that we have right now that are being brought to cost factors, pricing related to the squeeze on companies that have to pay these anywhere from 15 to 25% tariffs on the goods that are being imported. And it looks like, I hate to say this, a major win for China because they are getting immediately the delay of the tariffs ahead of anything they need to do. So while it's a very good show of faith by the United States and saying, you know what, okay, you want to come to the table, you want to do something, we'll do this little deal, which really has nothing to do with what we really were trying to accomplish anyway, but we'll do that. And then what we're going to do is we're going to go to phase two. And phase two, or maybe phase three, is going to deal with some of the harder items that we have no ability to really agree on, where China has said time and time again, there is no way that the United States is going to tell China what they can do or what they can't do with their state-run companies. No way that the Chinese are going to allow for America, the United States of America, to be involved with how they subsidize, don't subsidize, how they run, how they own, what they do with any state-owned enterprise. And on top of that, the difficulty in trying to understand these blacklisted companies that China has recently made a list of as well, that are going to probably throw against us as long as we keep the Huawei and several other companies that we have on that list and not allowing them to do business with companies here in the United States. I just don't see this as a deal. And I really wonder, maybe I'm going to be wrong here. I wonder, markets are smart, people are smart. They smell out a rat. And I wonder what's going to happen next week on this. It's interesting that President Trump did mention that he believes that the Fed should still lower rates even though they have a deal done. But the truth of the matter is, it doesn't seem like a deal is done. It doesn't seem like a partial deal is done. It doesn't seem like a skinny deal is done. In fact, it doesn't even look like phase one is done. So while we're being told this and it's being shoved down our throats, go out there and read for yourself what people are talking about. Read what Jeff Gundlach from Double Line is talking about. Read all the various newspapers. Pick whichever one you want. Look at analysis. I have not seen one that said, hey, this is substantial. They've all said it's an appeasement. Basically, the summation of everything that I looked at over the last couple of days has been simply, you know what? It's a step in the right direction. So that's good. I'll give credit for that. But when I look at this and I grade this overall, I got to tell you, if I was to grade this deal, I guess I would be generous and give it a C-. It doesn't look like it's a deal at all. Let's segue over to what's ahead. We just talked about all the things that happened. Next week's going to start earnings season. And primarily we have the banks and the financial institutions, a lot of others, but it's going to be a big week for the banks and the financials coming into next week, starting on Tuesday. And it's going to be interesting to hear, in particular, what the banks have to say. And I think the most important thing they're going to start talking about and we're going to be listening for is net interest margin, or NIM. It's their margins. And it's been a big problem with the shape of the yield curve recently that we've seen that banks have been having a very difficult time because, of course, we know that they lend out at the long end of the curve and, you know, that's where they get their money in. They pay out of the short end of the curve, and as the short end of the curve has moved up and the long end has moved down, the margin and the differential between the two has been converging. And as such, it's caused a squeeze on their margins. Now, banks have been doing okay this year, still lagging behind the general markets, but they've been doing okay. But the yield curve and the changes in the yield curve and the expectations of what the Fed is going to do has a pretty big impact on the banks and the financials, as you would expect. But we also have some other people that are going to be, or other companies that will be presenting earnings next week. And these are going to be pretty interesting because the brokerages, which recently dropped their trading commissions on ETFs and stocks and reduced the price of options like Schwab and TD Ameritrade and Fidelity, which is not publicly traded, but E-Trade, and the list goes on. These companies saw a major move lower on their stocks when this was all announced. And the competition and the way that was announced hit a few companies more severely than others who had much more exposure to revenues related to trading commissions. So, for example, TD Ameritrade or Ameritrade Financial had about, I think they lost about 28% of their market cap when this was announced that they were going to drop their rates to zero. We're going to hear from Schwab next week, and they're going to provide some of the outlook. I think the thing that we talked about last week, and I think it really bears mentioning again, is the whole idea with that now we're having trading commissions at zero, which doesn't mean they don't make anything on your trades. Obviously, they're going to be selling some of that off. They'll make some money on that. It may cost you some execution points that you may not actually see, but it's somewhere in there. It may cost you an eighth of a cent per share, or there may be a little bit of a delay because they're selling it off and finding where they can get the best opportunity. But the other question is, what are they going to do aside from this to make up for the losses on the revenues? And again, we talked about this a little bit, but I just want to mention it again. It's something that you really need to really focus on. And if you're working with some of these discount brokers, you have to wonder what other products they're going to start to look to promote. Watch your emails. Watch your house mail. Watch your office mail. Watch the telephone calls. Is there going to be a promotion of some of the other investment advisory or other products that they have that they could bring you into to create revenue and probably an ongoing revenue stream? And we've seen some of the big companies already come out with robo deals, and those were at no cost. For example, Schwab, as one of the examples, has a robo, totally automated investment program, but you use a lot of their funds. So you're going to see the use of proprietary funds that we talked about again in the, I believe it was the last episode, come to the fore. I think you're going to see this happening very significantly. Just keep your antennas up to find out where this is going to be. And one of the ways that companies in this area make money is on your cash left in their sweep accounts. So for example, in the sweep accounts, and I don't think you have a choice when you're in the Schwab, I think it's called the smart something, the smart portfolios. I don't think you have a choice of where you put cash. So the cash that's sitting on the account there, maybe it's a 20% position, maybe it's a 5% position, maybe it's a 40% position, depending on where your risk tolerance is, resides in their cash sweep account. The cash sweep account right now is yielding 0.12%. If you go into one of the money markets they have, they're yielding close to 1.7%. Ooh, that's a big difference. Now you say, it's only 1.5%, but you know what? Depending on how long you have that there, how much money you have, that adds up over time. That 1.5%, even if it's only a 20% position of cash in your portfolio, is 30 basis points of return. So just something to think about. And speaking of past episodes, by the way, if you recall, we discussed style diversification a couple episodes ago. And I think that somehow that hit a bit of a nerve, because we got a lot of comments and a lot of discussion, a lot of people wanting to understand more about it. I think it's really important. Obviously, the whole idea of understanding what true diversification is and isn't. I'm not going to go into a full-on discussion about this, but basically what I will tell you is this. Diversification is not just a lot of things, a lot of stuff, different names. You may have complete and a completely diversified portfolio in your mind, whereas you think, well, I have these 10 different mutual funds and these 3 ETFs in the portfolio and 2 different stocks. I think I have diversification because look at all the different types of managers I have and all that. But when you really look at it, well, they come down to being, let's just say, large cap core, large cap growth, large cap value, large cap balanced. And the overlap on what you actually have leads you to believe, when you look at this in totality, you really don't have diversification. And you wonder, no wonder why my portfolio just mimics the market. And that's not by, you know, any other reason by, well, you designed it to do that. You have these portfolios that are simply the same with a different label on each of them. That's like saying, well, I'm diversified. Look at all the different ketchup bottles I have. I got the Heinz, I got the Kraft, I got this one, I got that one, I got this. They're all ketchup. It's all ketchup. They may taste a little bit different, but generally speaking, it's all tomatoes. So when you look at your portfolio, make sure that you understand and stop for a second. And if you're saying, yeah, I'm diverse, stop. Think. Have you really put your portfolio to the test to make sure that you have diversification? Have you really ever done that aside from just assuming that you have diversification? That you have all the areas that you need to and appropriately according to your risk tolerance and your time horizon covered? Do you really have the best exposure to large cap growth, small cap growth, mid cap value, international large cap, emerging markets? Do you really have all that? And I'll tell you this, it really only takes one, maybe two, but one fund or ETF to cover a specific sector. That's all you need. So if you have a list of funds that say the ABC mid-cap fund and the XYZ mid-cap growth and the the 1-2-3 large cap, blah, 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 and you haven't really investigated what's inside the portfolio and how it reacts to market conditions and how it works on the correlation of all of this together, then you really haven't done the job that you need to do for your portfolio. Think about it, something that you may want to consider, and just, you know, go from there. Moving along to the next topic that I want to talk about. We have the VIX back at 15 again, in a 15 handle. Closed today on Friday, right above 15 and change. So this back to normal, what I would think is normal levels, as we see markets jump on Thursday and Friday, come down a little bit over the week, but we saw it kind of move up to about 22 earlier this month and then back down again. So this is giving me an inclination that we have not complacency, because that would be where the VIX, I think, would be in the 12 range or under. We had that for a while. There is volatility in the markets. It's not going anywhere, the markets. We're trading in a range, a gigantic range at that. But the VIX is back to, quote, normalized levels, as I see it at least. And again, this seems to be about right for where we are right now. And it's a market that has some volatility on a daily basis. But again, looking back under a longer time frame, you kind of say, well, you know what? It does have this kind of interim volatility, but longer, it doesn't really have much. What I think this does is it provides an opportunity for those that are fully invested, that if you feel that you want to be fully invested right now, for whatever reason, I'm not telling you right or wrong about doing it, but I'm saying, hey, you know what? If you are fully or close to fully invested, and that's what you're going to do in equities, I'm talking about invested in equities, you can consider maybe a plan of action to consider the idea that maybe it's a good time to pick up some volatility protection. Calling buying vol. That's the fancy way of saying it. We're buying vol. Yeah, we're buying vol. Or selling vol if you want to go the other way. And what I would be looking for right now is strike prices in the 20 range out or so into about December. And I want to kind of stop there for a second and just mention something. So in the past, I've had a lot of questions of, you know, I think there's going to be more volatility. What do I do? How do I deal with this? And the easiest way, it seems, for a lot of investors to do it is to go to one of these VIX ETFs. It's pretty easy because all you do is buy it. You don't have to know anything about options. Your accounts don't have to be set up for options. You don't have to understand things like strike prices, and you don't have to understand expiration dates. You don't have to worry about, you know, being called away and whatever. Options can be a little bit frightening for some people because there's a whole different terminology and process involved with options. So the question then becomes, well, should you buy the VIX and buy vol, go long vol, utilizing options or ETFs? And here's my take on this. While ETFs are a really easy way to gain exposure to this particular area of, you know, volatility in the market, or the fear index that we call it sometimes, for the most part, these have been, bad is an understatement, these have been disastrous investments. No matter what the symbol is on these, what they're doing is they're trying to emulate VIX exposure. And because there's a role on the various contracts and the way these are held, and because they are daily multipliers, in other words, they're really only geared for daily exposure and holding them over time, you'll find that you don't have a really good correlation to the VIX index. And more importantly, this is the important part, they have seen major decay of value due to the way that they're structured. In fact, a couple of times in the office, we've joked around about, it's not really a joke, it's serious. Every time you see one of these VIX products jump, because the VIX jumped, maybe it's up 20% to 30% over a period of time, what do? Short it. You short this every time, and you go look at a chart of UVIXY or TVIX or VXX. You take a look at that, and you tell me if there hasn't been an opportunity to short this. And one of the things you'll see, look way back, expand the range of the chart, because these things have seen reverse splits time and time again, because they keep on getting so low. They keep on reverse splitting and bringing it back up to a price, and they just sell off again. So there is a major decay involved in this particular type of ETF, especially the leveraged ones. So what does that mean? That means that you're probably better off using options in this particular area, and you should learn about doing this, of course, before you do this. Get your education, talk to an advisor, talk with somebody that can give you the opportunity. But basically what you'll be doing here in this concept is buying a call option on a, quote, bet that volatility is going to rise. Because options really are a little bit more of, I would say, speculation, gambling to a degree, versus core investing. And if you're going to be looking for volatility to rise, you could buy an option, a call option, something like a call option with a strike of 20 or 22 or something like that, out to December, in the third week of December for the option, which means, by the way, that if it doesn't get to that point, well, you lose the value of what you invested. Can't lose any more on buying a call. But the thing is here that you're not only looking for necessarily the VIX to be above your strike. So let's use 20 as our number. Because if you're on by the VIX option today, and let's say sometime in the future that strike price is 20, and let's say it's trading at a dollar right now, the VIX is at 15. So I'm going to restate that so you understand that. Right now, the VIX is trading at 15. The price of an option that gives you the right to buy the price to buy the VIX at, which basically is this option, at 20 in December is a dollar. A dollar per contract, it could be $100, is 100, that's how much to go, you multiply by 100. So it's going to be $100 per contract. Okay, $1, let's just use the $1. If the VIX goes up to, let's call it 18 possibly, very quickly, all of a sudden the price of that option may move from $1 to $1.40. Let me say, what's that? Well, that's a 40% increase. So while you didn't get to the level of 20 where the strike price is, in theory, what you just did was benefit from that volatility. Maybe the market came down a few hundred points in a matter of 2 days. Maybe, you know, 200, 500 points, another day of a couple hundred points, and the volatility index spikes a bit, and all of a sudden the options are dragged along with it, and there's a 40% increase or whatever the number is in the option. You could sell the option at that point, sell off the vol, sell off your long position in vol, and profit with that in that circumstance. Now, timing has to be right. The move has to be big enough. The strike price has to be appropriate. But again, if you have the idea that maybe there is some volatility coming or not, or if it happens in the future, think back on this discussion. And you can utilize this. Now, this is not for the faint of heart. It's not for the very conservative investor. There's really a lot of ways to be wrong on this than it is to be right. So make sure that you do your homework and seek professional advice from someone that can give you. But it's, you know, again, it's an opportunity to hedge out some of the risk in your portfolio over short periods of time of uncertainty and of market chaos, we'll call it. So again, one more point of summary. The VIX ETFs, if you use them for anything more than a day or two, I just think there's decay and it's not as, you don't get the real benefit, in my opinion, of the bang for the money that you do with an option. And for the last topic of this episode, I thought what we would do is we would talk a little bit about WeWork. Yes, we were worked. Investors were worked on this deal. This thing doesn't work. There's a couple of clips that I have that I want to share with you that tells a story, and then we'll kind of discuss this. And a lot of this started happening a couple of weeks back. And let me just give you a quick backdrop on this. We've been doing a lot of research on this area because we were wondering, you know, what kind of fallout is there if this whole WeWork craze, this shared office, flexible office space kind of euphoria runs into a big problem. And my concern is, well, what we found out was that a lot of the building and leases that have been done in major cities like New York, San Francisco, and London over the last number of years has really been supported by the companies that are in the flexible space, flexible office space and temporary office space, and companies that really are related to, like, you know, WeWork and some of these other companies like Regus and all that. But my concern really stemmed from the idea that, well, what happens if we have a situation that a company has taken over so much commercial property in areas and we have a slowdown on the economics, something happens, and from left field, we just find out that this whole WeWork valuation that went from $48 billion backed with a majority of backing by SoftBank starts to unravel. And we look into the IPO that failed, and all of a sudden we realize that they're needing about $6 billion or upwards of $9 billion to get them through, because there's only enough money really for the end of this year, because if they don't get any kind of funding, as they're burning through $700 million per quarter, that's their cash burn rate, $700 million per quarter. How? What's going to happen? And the idea that this shared and flexible workspace has been this real important to developers in major cities, and you have this now potential for a company that is facing a major problem financially, especially because on the long end, what they do is they buy and commit to long-term leases and then lease it out to smaller-time operators for the most part. And what they do is these are on short-term lease deals. So now you have a commitment for massive amount of funds into the future and a variable income. How does that work? So the fact that they pulled their IPO and the valuation went from about $48 billion down to about maybe $12 billion, well, that's a problem. I want to listen to some of these clips and then we'll comment on this, because this is something. And I'll mention also, we did write about this in our quarterly commentary. We sent that out to clients last week. It will be up on thedisciplinedinvestor.com very shortly. So keep a watch on the website over the next couple of weeks. You'll see that there's a complete discussion about this there. But let's listen into this right now.
WeWork is the largest commercial tenant in Manhattan with over 7 million square feet of space. And this building behind me highlights the risks both to landlords, lenders, and the broader real estate market. Now, it is partly owned by Adam Neumann, WeWork's founder. It is leased by WeWork and subleased by IBM. Now, the building is for sale right now for $110 million. Now, Neumann and his partners bought it a few years ago for $70 million, and there is now a loan on the building of $78 million. So lots of different levels of exposure here for other investors.
Let's take a break right there. Let's hold it right there. I mean, what we're looking at right now is that there is a building for sale, and what they're telling you is that they bought it for $70 million, and there's a $77 million loan on it. This is their headquarters in Manhattan, I believe off of Soho down the Village, I believe it is. And what they're really talking about here is what they want to sell the building for. But why are they selling the building? See, there's new two co-CEOs that came in. Adam Neumann has resigned as CEO. They're selling off planes. They're selling off real estate. They're slowing down, if not stopping, new lease deals. And the backdrop to what you're hearing here is because they are in a massive panic. There has been incredible amounts of spending on companies, on luxury items, and now that they're trying to get a grip on this, they're having to sell off core assets.
The sale comes amidst an oversupply of office space in New York, and there are some landlords who right now will no longer lease to WeWork, citing those risks. Now, the building coming on the market this summer, in part because Adam Neumann wanted to deflect those criticisms of self-dealing in advance of the IPO. That IPO, of course, now on hold.
So now we have some buildings for sale. And then they segued into another discussion with a real estate developer. There's a lot of business in New York, Don Peebles. So I thought we would just listen in on his comments on this. I thought this was really interesting.
And Don, as Robert just said, there are some landlords that now won't lease to WeWork. How big could these ripple effects be?
Well, I think they're significant. By the way, there have been many landlords who in WeWork's heyday, before they were undressed, who wouldn't lease to them. And so what you're going to see now is, I think, some defaults by WeWork are coming down the line. Certainly the buildings that they are tenants in are going to be penalized in their cap rates when they go to market to sell them because, frankly, cap rates are a reflection of the risk associated with commercial office buildings, and people are buying, investors are buying income stream and the dependability of it. And I think anyone looking at a building that's got significant WeWork occupancy has got to be very concerned,
right,
and will penalize that building.
So what you have here is a situation where the IPO went bad. The company is now perceived as having some financial distress and difficulties. They realize that there is going to be the potential for a major fallout due to the fact that if they don't get funding from some kind of emergency loans, that they probably will get some of this and maybe even rework some of the WeWork leases, that companies that are looking to possibly lease to WeWork will have it cost a bit much more money because of the risk factors associated with it. And their current deals are possibly going to be marked down a bit in terms of long-term valuation, and cap rates are going to be a problem on anything that they own. So there's this whole ripple effect that's happening already, and really nothing's changed. The only thing they did, and they probably did it incorrectly, was they went to the public markets for an IPO, and they had a pretty much show all of their financials. And when all of a sudden those financials came out, we were all like, what is going on here? And when the public finally found out about this, they realized that there is a major hole in their finances and it caused a lot of problems. Then we get to the whole issue of, well, what's happening in some of these major cities around the country, and in particularly Manhattan. This is Robert Frank from CNBC, and he deals with real estate and high-end real estate issues. And listen to what's going on in Manhattan right now and how they're, and then think through what could be the after effect due to this fallout.
Now, the problem here is that Manhattan right now has a huge oversupply of commercial space. You have projects like Hudson Yards and World Trade Center, and WeWork has absorbed much of that growth so far.
So where the problems come is where the next guest comments and where we'll see this fallout play out here.
If occupancies fall, if rental rates deteriorate because of the WeWork factor, among other things, you're going to see at some point a catalyst that's going to kick off a major repricing. And when that happens, it's sort of Katie bar the door.
Katie bar the door. Gotta love that phrase. Trouble ahead. Watch out. Be careful. There was another discussion by a Bernstein analyst that I got a clip from that discussed the whole idea of what was the fallout and the potential problems. Because remember, post-IPO, when we realized all these problems, what happened is that there was about a tremendous amount of money. They needed money. But let's listen to what she had to say.
Well, WeWork pulled its filing, as you said, but it is still badly in need of cash. And soon, Bernstein forecasts that the company is burning through $2.8 billion a year and that it will run out of money in the first half of next year. That's only a few months away, guys. So now, new co-CEOs Artie Minson and Sebastian Gunningham, they will have to prove to markets that they can turn around the business before that day comes. Now, there are big outside stakeholders in the success or failure of WeWork. SoftBank, of course, has poured more than $10 billion into the company. According to a report now, the conglomerate is tapping its own COO, Marcelo Claure, to help with the overhaul. Masa-san tapped him in the past to run and fix Sprint. Now, another major stakeholder in this whole WeWork saga, commercial landlords. Remember, WeWork is the largest private sector tenant in New York and London. As it looks to cut costs and slow growth, there are some concerns that it could affect the commercial real estate market. A Raymond James note, though, says WeWork likely accounted for less than 2% of office leasing activity in all of the U.S. last year. That number, though, it climbs to 3.6% in Manhattan and 4% in San Francisco.
So while we're not thinking that there's necessarily going to be a major disastrous problem with this, I do think this is something that needs to be focused in on, because if the major absorption in the commercial real estate space over the last couple of years, particularly in London, which has, I think, accounted for 25% of all the leases that were done over the last 2 years, were flexible space types of deals. The problem is that we start to see that if, in fact, rates come down, slowing down in terms of building and construction, and then you have the obvious layoff of construction individuals, banks may get a little skittish because they can get banged up on some of the loans they have outstanding. And you may see a little bit of a problem in the commercial real estate space. Now, this has no, I don't think there's any real correlation, or you could really extrapolate this and say, well, it's very much like what happened back in the days when there was an overage of building and speculation in the housing area back when. The leverage in the system is not as great, but the fact is that this could cause some problems that we need to be aware of that could have a ripple effect through the commercial markets around the world, and especially these areas that we're talking about. Something to think about. We'll have more on this and more details on this on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can also just simply sign up for our mailing lists over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll send you a copy of that as well. Other than that, I want to thank you for joining me this week. We're going to have an interesting week ahead, I do think. You can ask me any questions. Find out more information over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Go over to the Ask Andrew section. Just say hello. Tell me what you think. Send me your comments. Tell me if you love us or hate us or anything in between, any questions that you may have. Make sure to listen, of course, to myself and John C. Dvorak on DH Unplugged on Tuesdays. I will also be the guest on Investors Business Daily podcast this coming week. So we'll get that out to you as well. Follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is the Twitter handle. And if you have any desire for us to manage your money, just give us a shout. Plenty of ways to contact us all over the place. And we'll do our best to give you some good insight, review your diversification, and provide you with an honest solution that we think is most appropriate. Until next week, adios. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.